The voluntarist philosophy has at its foundation two principles from which the ethical nature of any and all human action is determined. The first of these two is the principle of self-ownership, which states that we are the exclusive controllers and therefore owners of our own sovereign bodies. And by extension, we also own our actions and the effects of those actions. From this line of reasoning, we are able to derive the criteria for legitimate property acquisition and titling. In short, property may only be acquired through the acts of original appropriation or voluntary contractual exchange. Now, the second principle is that of non-aggression, otherwise known as the NAP. This principle grants each person the natural right to live free of coercive or aggressive interference by another individual. Coercion here is defined as the explicit application or threat of harm to a person's body or property by another human being. From this principle, we may conclude that for an act to be considered criminal requires a victim of coercion, as previously defined. In short, if there is no victim, then there may be no crime.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Peaceful Anarchism on the Voluntary Virtues Network every Thursday at 1 p.m. And you could also find me on theconsciousresistance.com and theseedsofliberty.com. So today we have Christopher Chase Rachels coming in from Asheville, North Carolina. He's an anarcho-capitalist, peaceful parenter of a 13-month-old boy, and he's a future unschooler, although he would tell you that he's already unschooling because education happens since birth, right? It's always happening. We're always learning. And he's a co-founder of the Blue Ridge Liberty Project, author of the book A Spontaneous Order, The Capitalist Case for a Stateless Society, which I'm reading right now. Very awesome book. Highly recommend it. We'll get into that. And he's a host of ANCAP Radio. And also, he has a podcast, First Degree Liberty, with Mike Martelli. So the website is brlp.org for the Blue Ridge Liberty Project. And his website for the book is not yet up, but it will be quite soon. It'll be aspontaneousorder.com. And his YouTube channel, youtube.com/AncapChase. That's actually how I found him a couple of years ago. Very grateful for that. Puts up some awesome content there, so check that out. And Facebook, you can find the Blue Ridge Liberty Project as just that name, Blue Ridge Liberty Project. So very cool. Christopher, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Yes, thank you for having me, Danilo. It's a great pleasure to be here.
So I heard about your work, a few years ago through the ANCAP Chase, and I never actually knew who you were because you never showed your face, right, in your videos, right?
It's always just
your voice, so I never knew who you were, even on Facebook. Like, who is this guy? And then finally I put the name, Chase, ANCAP Chase. Makes sense. Very, very cool. So I love your work. I've been following you for a while. I've learned a lot from it. So, and now I'm, continuing to learn from your book. So that's really awesome. So before we get into that, can you give us a little bit of history, regarding your background, how you came to anarcho-capitalism and peaceful parenting?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, like many other ANCAPs, I started off as a neoconservative, and in 2008, I just graduated high school and I joined the military. And around that same time, I also discovered Ron Paul running his 2008 campaign. And I loved everything about Ron Paul with the exception of foreign policy. So because of that, I did a little more research and reading and realized he was pretty on target with the foreign policy as well. And after that, it was just a gradual progression to becoming progressively more libertarian. I read a lot of Andrew Napolitano stuff. I became more of a constitutionalist, minarchist. And then finally, once I got out of the military, I started reading a lot more about Austrian economics, studying a lot more Mises.org. And Stefan Molyneux was even actually helpful to get me transitioning from minarchy to anarchy. And since then, I probably was an ANCAP. And 2011 is when it actually happened, and since then I've just been trying to increase my knowledge and research more and read more, and that's kind of what inspired me to write this book, because I realized that there are so many different things and questions I had, and I couldn't find one single book that had referenced every single one of the common objections and common critiques. So I kind of wanted to create a product that wasn't already existing in the market and put that out there.
Yeah, that's a great reason to write something, you know, like the book you wrote. It's like, you know what? I want to find this type of book, but it's not there. So let me just write it. I'm just going to write it for those people that maybe are in my position, right?
Exactly.
But yeah, it's great. I'm currently reading. I'm like halfway through it. It's very thorough, very, informative. You know, it's really, really awesome book. You know, it's, takes apart, you know, in quite exquisite detail the you know, Austrian economics theory, so I highly recommend it. So what about the Blue Ridge Liberty Project? How did that come about? I'm just curious if you can share a little bit of the background with that.
Right, so I met Justin Stout when right after the military. I went to University of South Carolina for a semester. I was going for my political science degree. And I met Justin Stout, and he was into Ron Paul too, but he was also at the time a voluntarist, and he's the one that kind of introduced me to voluntarism, anarcho-capitalism, and it was an idea that I wanted to believe in, but I just didn't think it'd be practical. But, you know, after doing a lot more research, I found that it was actually not just practical, but much more practical than the state is. So he had, for a long time, had this idea of starting a Southern version of the FSP, but not even just like the FSP, but also more focused. Like, instead of being just more liberty, just less government, we want this to be explicitly voluntarist with a special emphasis on peaceful parenting as well. So after I had known for about a year or so, we ended up choosing Asheville as what we thought to be the perfect location to start this project. We liked the culture up there. We thought it was very conducive to these ideas. People there are known for thinking outside the box, for being very peaceful. The culture there is also very much into the homeschooling stuff. They're much into the peaceful parenting stuff already. There's a lot of agorism that goes on there, even though most of them wouldn't know that it goes by that name, but it happens. The mountains are great. Lush, beautiful soil. I mean, I could just go on and on with all the reasons we loved Asheville. And we decided to make the project there, and we think it's been a great success so far. We're really excited to see where it's going to continue to take us, and it's going to continue to grow. And we're just kind of along for the ride, and we're just looking forward to tomorrow, seeing what comes our way. And of course, we're becoming much more active and organized as each day passes. So we're really excited.
Yeah. I really like the idea of, you know, people of like mind, you know, coming together and, you know, uniting with a common cause like that, because, you know, it's one thing to live, you know, maybe where you grew up or, you know, where you went to school and having the friends there that you had since childhood. And then once you change your philosophy, it becomes kind of difficult to continue those relationships. You know, you would like to, but it's just like you begin to clash, right, too much. And you're like, damn it, now something has to give, you know, right?
Yeah, oh, you're exactly correct. And it's unfortunate because many people who are into voluntarism or peaceful parenting, because I personally believe they go very much hand in hand, the people who are into those things tend to be like the only one or one of two in their town. And they just crave community and more social interaction. So because there's not other people like that where they live, they're forced to settle for people who don't share all their values, who maybe aren't so much in the peaceful parenting or aren't so much in the voluntarism. Maybe they have one part of the picture but not the other. So we wanted to create a little sanctuary, if you will, to where people wouldn't have to sacrifice community to live their beliefs, live their values, and to be able to talk about them openly. You know, unfortunately, most people feel like censored in most situations because they know if they talk very openly about one of these issues, because they're not very popular, that they're going to be sacrificing their community and be ostracized to a small degree. So we really were excited about the community, but also what goes along with having more people in a concentrated area is there's many more opportunities to synergize efforts for various activists. And So it's just really cool. It's pretty cool all around, and I'm very happy with how it's turned out, and I'm really excited to see where it's going in the future.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. I mean, yeah, you're right. The chilling effect where, you know, you want to, you know, you're learning about these awesome ideas and you want to share them. But then at the same time, if you become vocal with those around you that are not, that don't share those ideas, then yeah, the ostracism can occur where they just shun you because you just seem so eccentric.
Like, oh, yeah.
Like, wait a minute. We should apply the same morality to government that we... Wait, that's too weird.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah, it's too much logical consistency for some people.
Right. Everybody has grown up with the double standard, you know, legal plunder, right? You know, what? If it's taxation, it's not immoral, right? Because it's taxation, right? I mean, you just got to change... You change the word, it just makes it moral.
So. Oh, yeah. Yeah, once you enter the status institution, you enter the public sphere, morality just kind of stands on its head, and it's just completely backwards. So
right. So yeah, that's really it's really great that that you guys want to change. You know, you want to get together with other like-minded people because it's right. You know, it's like you know we can affect change. You know, scattered and, you know, one by one, those around us. But then you're right. Once we come together, our message is that much more powerful and focused, right? And then we support each other and then even better. So yeah, such an awesome idea. So let's get into your book a little bit. So you go into the various, like different aspects of Austrian economics, right? Like contract and banking and things like that. So yeah, can you get into a little bit of those?
Yeah, I do. It's pretty much a fusion, not of just Austrian economics, but also a lot of libertarian philosophy, of course, and a political theory. Because Austrian economics itself, it's value free. So I mean, it just tells you how the economy works, but it doesn't necessarily entail a certain political order, right? It just says if you do X, then Y will happen. So you really need to have a fusion of the two in order to make a case for a particular social order, which of course I'm arguing for a voluntarist or anarcho-capitalist social order. And yes, you're absolutely right. I start from the very foundation with the epistemology and praxeology, and those are like the basis of Austrian economics. And then I move on to prove the private property ethic, or what we know as a libertarian ethic, that is private property rights and the non-aggression principle. And I utilize Hans Hermann Hoppe's argumentation ethics to help me do this. So we're not just making people accept the NAP and private property on face value, but I'm actually giving them a rational proof which shows the validity and the soundness of these concepts. And then I move on to property, talking about what it is and what it's not, and then to contracts, what are enforceable valid contracts, what wouldn't be considered enforceable contracts, and then money and banking, insurance, healthcare, monopolies and cartels. And then I move into applications, like I already said, healthcare, but we also look into how law and order might function and why it might be more efficient and ethical, of course. Same thing with defense and security, as well as education, environmentalism, poverty, roads, of course. You got to have the roads in there. And I also go take a chapter to look at the corporation itself, because I think there's a lot of misconceptions regarding what a corporation is. And then finally, I end the book off with a chapter on getting there, which includes what I believe to be the most effective means that we can actually achieve this free society, which I talk about and make a case for in the book. So I think it's probably one of the most comprehensive works out there, and I try to make it comprehensive without sacrificing a lot of the thoroughness for making the argument, the rigor of the argument of the case for each of those things. So it's a very delicate balance to be thorough yet concise, and not have like a 1,000-page tome at the end of it. So I hope I accomplished that end. So we'll see.
Yeah. So. Like, I'm just curious, any objections that people have had, like, reading that, or you know, just you, people around you that you talk about volunteerism and and anarcho-capitalism. Like some people have told you, like, you know, come on, Chase, you're just being too utopian. You're idealistic. Okay. This can happen. Come back to the real world. Like, some people say that to you?
Well, it's funny you mention that, because I think my father is probably my harshest critic, and he himself is a minarchist. He's, you know, a self-proclaimed libertarian. But again, he's a very harsh critic, and in fact, he's a pretty smart guy, so he probably makes some of the most sophisticated critiques of anarcho-capitalism or anarchy in general. Mm-hmm. So his critiques have really kind of inspired the book in many ways, because it got me thinking about I don't want to just address all the softball objections to anarcho-capitalism. I want to address the toughest, most sophisticated objections. Mm. That way the case is very ironclad. So just about any common objection or very hard objection to anarchy I could think of has pretty much been addressed in the book. And if someone has objections even still, when they realize I have this book out there, they probably haven't read it. So, I mean, I haven't yet come across an objection that's not addressed in the book. I'll just put it that way. And I'm sure there's some out there, but I haven't encountered it yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny that you know, the people that you know, are pro-government, they when we begin to, you know, it's okay to criticize the government, right? It's okay to say, you know, Obama's healthcare sucks, right? Or, you know, we need tax reform, or we need, you know, education reform. That's acceptable. But then once you say, you go a little bit further, and you're like, you know what? Maybe we should get the government out of everything. Maybe it's completely inefficient. Maybe we don't need it at all. And then I'm like, oh my God, you are a crazy or wacko. You're fanatic. You're off your rocker. You know, go back to your medications.
Right?
Yeah. you get that?
Yeah, everyone wants to shrink the cancer, but no one wants to eliminate it.
Right.
Yeah. You know, along that same vein, I think it's very easy for many people to identify what are the quote-unquote issues of society, what are the problems, and many people more or less are pretty on point when it comes to what are the issues. However, very, very few people can offer us a coherent solution or superior alternative in order to deal with these issues. They just know this is bad, but they very, very rarely can give us what's better. So I wanted the book to be very solution oriented. I do talk about the state and its weaknesses and its flaws very much in the book, but only so I can contrast them with the superior alternative that is voluntarism, anarcho-capitalism, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. So I think that's very important. We don't want to just be anti X, Y, or Z. We want to be pro A, B, and C too. You mm-hmm. know, we want to show people we want X, not just we don't want Y.
Right. Yeah, you're right. People want to hear solutions. They don't want to hear complaints. And one thing that I remember when I first got into this this stuff maybe a few years ago, my mother, who is quite a passionate, she calls herself a social democrat / progressive / socialist. She's quite proud of that. And one of the things she says to me is, in your anarchy society, how would X work? So basically, the first problem with that is, I'm like, well, first of all, it's not my society. Okay, I'm not the dictator, I'm not the emperor. Okay, I don't make these decisions. That's the whole idea of not having a ruling class, right? Of not having government is that you know, things are decided based on market demand, right? Based on consumer choice, right? Mm. And that's beautiful. And that's what brings about, you know, the unforeseen advances in progress and wealth that's created when entrepreneurs, you know, innovate, right? Like, you can't predict that. You can't put a gun to somebody's head and say, make an iPhone.
Absolutely.
Right? Invention, creation doesn't happen like that, right?
Yeah, I think it's because they're so used to this method of analyzing different types of social order, because they never really considered a stateless social order. So whenever they ask, well, who would do this, who would do that, they're in that central planning mindset, because every other social order, it's always some form of central blueprint. Oh, well, you know, the Department of Transportation is going to handle the roads, and the Department of Justice is going to handle the law and order, whatever. Uh-huh. So, that's why when I have a chapter on each of these issues, I'm not sitting there saying, the roads are going to be funded and constructed in exactly this way, and they're going to run exactly that. What I do is instead is I say, here is economically why a free market environment will produce a more efficient setup, and of course do so in a more ethical way. I just show them the economics of why it would be better. But as far as the specific form it would take, like you said, if we can know that in advance, that'd be an argument for central planning, for statism, not for anarchy. It's precisely because we cannot know in advance what's the optimum way to actually provide these services that we need the market, that we need the prices to help show us if we're satisfying consumer demands or not, that we need the profit and loss system. And really, it's humility. It's accepting and being and having that humility, which allows us to see that, okay, maybe not one person or a small group of people know what's best for everyone else. Maybe we should let the bottom up process of the market organically show us what's the best way to do things.
Right. Yeah. Like I was talking about democracy recently on one of my posts on Facebook, and this one person said, you know, so you hate democracy so much. What do you want? A dictatorship? You want one person? You want one person deciding? It's like. Well, if you go to a restaurant and you don't want everybody voting what everybody should eat, right? One thing. We want one person voting what everybody should eat. And so the idea that no, actually individuals can make their own choices does not even come into their mind. Like you said, like every single social order, you know, everything, every single ism is force, right? Is government coercion. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that's not is anarchy or statelessness or or voluntarism. That's the only thing that lacks that coercion, and people it's just way off their radar.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And the funny thing is you know, in a sense, in a free market, you are voting, but you're voting with your dollars.
Right.
And the number of votes you have, so to speak, is directly proportional to how much you previously produced. Because the more productive you are, the more money you get, the more quote-unquote votes you get.
Yeah.
So the impact the impact you have on the direction of the market is directly correlated to how productive you've been. And how productive you've been just means, it's just shorthand for how much value you've added to society. How much you've taken some goods that were valued less separately. The sum of them are valued less separately. When you put them together, they're valued more than the sum of their individual parts. Like you literally created value. You produced value that wasn't there beforehand. So it's a beautiful system, and the market's very fickle. People are very fickle. You're not going to be able to produce the same product forever and be incredibly profitable. And again, because we have the market and the pricing mechanism, it allows us to mold and shape and be fluid and evolve according with the ever-changing whims of the consumer. So it's not only does it satisfy all of our desires now, but provides a way in which we can continue to satisfy people's changing desires in the future in relation to what we have access to. It's incredible. It's beautiful.
Yeah, and what's interesting to me is that when we talk about the immorality of government and ruling class and how, you know, people should be free, people equate, like, what do you want to go back to, you know, caveman times? You want to go back to living in the woods, you know, primitivism and things like that. So basically what they're doing is they're associating progress, technological progress and intelligence and philosophy and economics and every single, you know, piece of knowledge that people have discovered to government. Like, government was responsible for all of that. And if we didn't have that, we would be back in the barbaric times, right?
Yeah. Well, I think Rothbard had a very pertinent quote that went along those lines. And he said something to the effect, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he said that the greatest non sequitur committed by defenders of the state is to say that the necessity of civilization is what makes the state necessary. Like, basically that if you want civilization, you need the state. You can't have civilization without the state. And that's a complete non sequitur. Like,
right.
It doesn't follow that we want civilization, therefore a state. That doesn't follow. You can have a civilization without the state. In fact, I would argue, of course, just like I'm sure you would, that we would have a much more civilized civilization without the state. A much less even chaotic civilization without the state, even though the irony is that the anarchists are viewed as advocates for chaos and destruction and opponents to civilization.
Right, yeah, and that's the whole idea with taxation. It's your civic duty. You know, you want to contribute your fair share. We live in a civilized society. Of course you're going to pay taxes. And exactly what you said. I'm like, well, if the definition of a civilized society is that, you know, there's a ruling class that's exempt from the laws of morality that everyone else is subject to, and they can arbitrarily dictate the laws and taxes that are imposed on that majority by threat of punishment and violence, I would say actually that's an uncivilized, that's actually a barbaric society. That's a primitive society right there. You're not living off of, you know, you're not living by intelligence and creativity, you're just living by brute force. You know, that's the appeal to the stick.
Oh yeah, well, and of course that section of society, the state itself can only live parasitically off of those who rely upon their intelligence and productivity to produce value for others on a voluntary basis. So yeah, they're only holding us back. It's just a big obstacle, and that parasite just grows ever more large until our civilization implodes and we start from scratch.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
That's happened time and time again.
Right, and that's the problem is that, you know, that how many revolutions have there been, and collapses and wealth transfers and hyperinflations, and they don't seem to get it. They don't, you know, people don't look back in history and say, wait a minute, I think this happened before. Maybe we should try something different this time. No, they're who should rule next? Who are we going to put into power?
Well, unfortunately, they do try different things sometimes, but they're always different forms of states. They're
never
saying, maybe the premise is flawed. Maybe it's not that we don't have the right state, but maybe we don't need the state at all.
Right.
So I think we'll make it there eventually, but as far as when that will be, I guess no one knows.
Yeah, and just, you know, the idea that, I tell people we're not, you know, anarchists or volunteers are not fortune tellers, we're not oracles, we can't predict the future, right? All that we really know, and all that I think that it's important to know, is that, you know, something is moral or immoral, right? That's the crux of the whole argument. And if you can determine that the government is the essence of immorality, and that it's fundamentally inefficient and wasteful and unnecessary, that we can do away with it and actually be more prosperous, we don't need to know, you know, what kind of roads will be built. We don't need to know how, you know, we're going to get around, you know, what cars or what planes, or maybe we won't even need cars. We'll have teleportation. Maybe we would have had that, you know, decades ago. Who knows? If the market does not hold back.
Yeah, and I think the objection that gets put forth to that all too often is, okay, well, maybe the government isn't the pinnacle of morality, however, it's conducive to achieving some more utilitarian ends, some more practical ends. And really, you can't really separate what's moral from what's practical. I mean, on the net, you're going to have much more even material prosperity by adhering to the non-aggression principle, by respecting private property rights. And you're going to be having more individual prosperity by not being an antisocial asshole, you know, by forming networks, by being empathetic, by always sticking true to your word, by not committing fraud. I mean, these are all things which aren't just moral, they're practical. And I think they're really two sides of the same coin.
Right. And the other thing that's kind of, for me, is very significant is the fact that, you know, the market forces that determine what business will survive and what will perish are completely turned upside down when government coercion is introduced. You know, there is no market, you know, when the Department of Education hijacks education and you know, forces people to go or forces people to fund it regardless if you go or not. And so what is the incentive? Is the incentive to have better and better teachers, or for the quality to just plummet, right?
It's the opposite, yeah.
Right, exactly. So, and that, you know, basically on every, you know, every single government program, just go down the line, you know, Federal Reserve, the Department of Transportation, Department of Justice, you know, EPA, anything you can think of, you know, once force is required to fund it and people are no longer given the choice to opt out or to boycott it, then they don't really need to care about how they treat people, right? Or their quality of service, right?
Well, I mean, that's the moral hazard, right? Yeah. If the funding is guaranteed, then what's the incentive? So at that point, their only incentive really is to just maintain some superficial level of popularity, you know? So that is much easier to do than to actually continue persuading people to be a patron of the service, right? So when your funding is guaranteed, yeah, like you said, they're in the advantageous position to where if their services suck, they'll be like, hey, obviously our services suck, so we need more money to make them better.
Right.
And if they're great, they're like, look, we have a successful program. Our services are great. Reward us with more money. You know, no matter what happens, they're always going to get more money.
Right, right, right. Yeah, exactly. Completely perverted market forces. And
yeah.
So, and something like that would never, you know, it would never survive in the market. Like, you know, I tell people, you know, let's say somebody's a business owner. I'm like, do you think if your business fails, you're going to get a bailout?
Right.
And why is that? Why will you not get a bailout? And why will that bailout instead go to, you know, JP Morgan Chase, Capital One, Bank of America, you know, you know, BP or Monsanto or whatever. And, and the difference is, do they offer any value to society compared to what you are offering? You know, you are being, you know, most of your stuff is voluntarily acquired, but you know, I mean, I guess Monsanto in a certain sense, you know, people voluntarily seek buy their stuff, but for the most part, I think, you know, remove the subsidies, remove the favoritism, remove the regulatory capture, and they just collapse. They can't survive in the market, without it.
Yeah, and even if they didn't collapse, they of course wouldn't be nearly as profitable as they are. And that we can say that for certain.
Yeah, like I like to think that I forget who said this, but you know, if you remove all the guns and all the violence from the government, you know, all that's left is a crappy business with an inferior product that nobody wants to buy.
I think that's true of a lot of businesses out there, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. So it just it doesn't add up. But let me ask you, with your family, how does your family? I know you mentioned your father, but are you, do you have brothers and sisters? How do they feel regarding libertarianism and anarchy?
Well, like I said, my dad is ironically probably the closest to me ideologically. Like he identifies as a libertarian or minarchist, if you will. My brother, he's very apathetic. He couldn't care less. But he is an Army veteran, and he's very proud of America.
Yeah. Wow.
So he's kind of a nationalist.
Wow.
So, you know, I don't think that he would in any way care about libertarianism. Yeah. Same thing with my stepmother, with my own mother. She's a, you know, good old-fashioned Republican. So, I mean...
Right.
No one other than myself is really into voluntarism in my extended family, and my dad is probably the closest.
But, yeah. Yeah, it's really amazing how, you know, how we come through these realizations and we learn about philosophy and economics, and certain people are interested and certain people just don't care or they just don't want their sacred cows destroyed.
Yeah, they don't want to threaten their government cheese.
Right, and I was talking to Bill Buport a couple of weeks back, and he was saying that, you know, sacred cows make the best burgers. So
nice.
So So I mean that's the thing with most people, if you have the humility to accept that your previous beliefs were wrong, and that's the only way that you can improve yourself, right? And become smarter and increase your intelligence, right? Is if you can accept, you know what, maybe what I was thinking yesterday wasn't altogether correct. Maybe this is better, you know? And I think that's a very humble, it's a humble admission, right? That you know, we don't know everything and maybe we're continue learning. Every day we're learning something new, right? And to think that some people just get stuck, like they have a wall, they build the wall and they're like, that's it, I'm done. I'm not learning anything new. After today, like, it's, I don't know, it's, it just seems, yeah, like you said, I guess some people are just apathetic, some people are just scared, maybe, of the possibility that, you know, the biggest agency of oppression is not, you know, people in turbans and sandals, you know, across an ocean, you know, that live in a desert. Maybe, just maybe, they're here at home and they call themselves the government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. About the apathetic people, you really can't do much about, unfortunately. You know, no matter what you produce or do, they don't care. They don't care. But hopefully those who do care and who genuinely want to remedy a lot of these complex social issues we're faced with and have an open mind are going to be the ones who, like you said, are humble enough to accept these ideas. And I hope those people are willing to read and consume my book. I think that would help with just about anyone. I pretty much can't imagine anyone reading it and not being more libertarian than they were when they started. That is, if they're not already an ANCAP or a voluntarist.
Right.
So that's pretty cool. Like you said, for me, I used to be a neocon. And so that's a radical shift from neocon to where I am today. And for most of us, I think very, very small percentage of us started out from anarchy. Well, I mean, technically, I guess we're babies. But, you know, like from like... when we can actually think about politics, or I think most of us started from the state and had to let that go. And for anyone, that's a radical shift, no matter who you are. So, yeah, humility is the key.
Yeah, you know, I firmly believe that you know, we're all born anarchists. We don't recognize authority figures, and that we have a basic innate understanding of private property. You know, by, you know, the simple things that toddlers say, you know, it's mine. You know, you said so. I got it first, right? I think these are like implied verbal contracts. Like, you know, if you said that, you know, this is yours, and then you say no, and actually now it's mine, then they're gonna say no, you said it's mine, right?
So yes.
In that way, I think that, you know, we're all born anarchists, but kind of gets beaten out of us through you know, authoritarian parenting, spanking, and then later on, you know, punishment, and also and then through government schooling. Indoctrination. So
12 years of that, absolutely.
yeah like I think it was Stalin that said, like, you know, give me your child for 4 years and this is the seed I planted would never be uprooted. And that's only 4 years, right? And today we have 12 years.
Yeah, that's true for most people. And, you know, I even went to the military for 4 years after that, so I got a very large heaping dose of statist propaganda.
Yeah, it's really amazing. You know, yeah, when I meet other veteran voluntarists, or, you know, veterans that are voluntarists or anarchists, I mean that's really an amazing leap to take, because being a soldier is, or I guess same thing with the police, is like one of the most nationalistic things that you can do. You're actually sacrificing your not only your time but your life possibly for your country, right? For nationalism.
Oh yeah, for at least what you believe,
right.
Country. Yeah.
So were you like very influenced by 9/11? Is that what wanted you to, you know, impelled you to join the military?
No, actually, I didn't really have very nationalistic motivations. They're more just I guess they're more self-interested ones. I like the idea that I'll pay for my school after I get out. I thought it'd be good to build my confidence and gain some cool skills along the way. So I was never really very nationalistic, I guess. And I think that's kind of what helped me stay open to these new libertarian ideas and what helped me give Ron Paul a fair chance, even with the foreign policy, which I initially disagreed with. So I was always the very libertarian. I was an intelligence analyst in the military, in the Air Force. So I was always a very obnoxious libertarian guy in the room talking about, do we really have the authority, the just authority to do this, to collect these cell phone transmissions? Should we be going to war with these guys? Should we not be just leaving these guys alone? What the hell is going on? I mean, so the military, having that perspective and having that really neat insight as an intel analyst, I think really hastened my awakening as opposed to stunted it. But unfortunately, most in the military have the opposite effect. They just kind of get consumed by the propaganda because, you know, to admit that what you're doing is supporting aggression and evil on a massive scale creates a lot of cognitive dissonance.
Oh, yeah.
So you have to rationalize that some way if you want to not just live with yourself but even be proud of yourself. So
yeah, definitely. Did you see the movie The American Sniper?
No, I haven't. I have not seen that.
Is that out of some disgust for what it's about, or just haven't gotten a chance to it?
I just don't feel the particular desire to go, right. You know, watch 2 hours of American nationalist propaganda.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, me too. I haven't seen it either, but I think I know pretty much what it's about completely because of what so many people have said about it. Mm-hmm. I heard that Clint Eastwood, who directed the movie, was actually he's actually slightly libertarian, you know. So the way he made the movie was not really to promote nationalism, from what I understand. It was to promote or to demonstrate the horrors of war. You know, because mm-hmm. he showed all the gruesome details. He showed, you know, Chris Kyle shooting down, you know, kids and women, and so he tried to incite disgust for the war on terror in the population. And interestingly enough, in some people who were fiercely nationalistic, it had the complete opposite. It strengthened their nationalism, right?
Their resolve, yeah. Yeah, you know, I did, however, watch the Adam Kokesh interview a bunch of people after watching that movie. Like, he went to the movie theaters, and after they come out of the movie theater, he interviewed them and asked them some questions and kind of do the Socratic method to make them come to some somewhat reasonable conclusions, and it was really entertaining.
You know what I get when I talk to people like that? Like, you know, the very simple question, like Larkin Rose, he's like, you know, you can't, it's immoral for you to rob your neighbor, right? It's immoral for a group of you to rob your neighbor. What about if you vote for a politician to rob your neighbor? Is it still more, you know? And I say that kind of simple line of questioning, and I get so often people say, you know, you're overgeneralizing, you're oversimplifying, life is more complicated than that.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, it's always the necessary evil argument you get back to that, like, there. Well, it's, well, you know, it does suck, but it's what needs to be done if we want to maintain an orderly society, a civilization. We're gonna have to break a few eggs to make an omelet. You know, that's always kind of the retort. You know,
yeah,
that's kind of why I wanted to address a lot of those practical comebacks. Like, actually, no, this is actually a bad way to make an omelet.
and also, you know, aside from the necessary evil, it's also an appeal to authority. It's like, I don't know. I it's impossible for me, the plebeian, you know, the simpleton, the peasant, to understand economics. So I'm just going to leave it to the experts in government. And, you know, they, you know, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, I'm sure he knows what he's doing.
Oh, yeah.
With the currency. Let's just leave it to him. Stop trying to ration it out for yourself. Don't try to.
Well, you know, that's funny. That's a complaint that many Austrians have of mainstream economics, whether it's Keynesian or even Chicago School, mm-hmm. is that they joke that the more obscure you make your findings and your research, the more recognition it gets, you know, because people tend to all too often equate obscurity with profundity and truth, and that's not true. And most economics, the methodology they use for their analysis is just fundamentally flawed. And that's what's so cool about Austrian economics, because it's logically deductive from incontrovertible starting points. It's all very sensible. And unfortunately, like you said, all this propaganda has made people believe, well, gosh, that just makes too much sense. That can't be right because it makes too much sense. Because it sounds too simple. This can't be right. That sounds too... It's got to be more complicated than that. Yeah. If I don't understand it, then it's probably right.
Right. You know, yeah. You know, so. If I'm confused, that's a good sign.
So that's the double thing they've instilled in us. And it's the same with politics and everything else. If they try to obfuscate or make it... all this word salad, incoherent language, they're probably trying to distract you from the reality of the situation.
Exactly. And like, you know, we tell people, you know, no, actually the minimum wage causes more unemployment, destroys, you know, the less skilled, you know, they have less ability to, you know, start in the job world and gain experience. And they're like, you know what? If Obama thinks that the $15 minimum wage is going to help, you know, the poor, then I think he's right, because he has good intentions and he probably knows what he's doing, because he went up there and he was very forceful and clear in what he said. So I think...
Now let me be clear.
Right. So yeah, you're right. It's just, it's really amazing how, you know, people, they don't like to acknowledge their own thought processes. You know, they mm-hmm. doubt the simplicity. Like, you know, I love Einstein's quote, you know, if you can't explain it simply, you don't understand it well enough.
Sure.
And,
absolutely.
And I constantly say that to people, because you're right. Like, Austrian economics is really awesome in that regard, is that, you know, it's based on human action, right? And incentives. What are people incentivized to do in a certain situation, right? And if we look in history, you know, a lot of things repeat. You know, there's a lot of repetition. Mm-hmm. And if you're really careful with the way you study human action, you can basically deduce how people will act. It's not to say you can predict the future, but you do have a general idea, right? We don't need a formula to figure out, you know, how the minimum wage will, you know, bring in more automation into McDonald's.
Yeah. But, you know, of course, however, it's really easy to promise people the world and free college and free healthcare and more pay. Those are easy ways to buy more votes.
Oh, yeah.
And you don't even have to follow through on these promises. So they're free. Yeah. I don't even have to actually give you, I can just promise it to you and you'll vote for me and say, fuck you. You know, so I mean, if you get the $15 minimum wage, even if it passes, I'm still screwing most of you out of job altogether.
Right.
Some of you might benefit and might be lucky enough to be seen as worth more than $15 an hour.
Right.
But most of you, you're going to be unemployed and it's going to be even harder to find a job. I mean, it's so crazy. It really is. And of course, when you object to these things, people just think, oh, you're just being selfish and greedy. You just think that these aristocrats or these oligarchs, these greedy capitalists, you know, they're getting millions of dollars in bonuses. You know, why can't these guys just make a few more dollars an hour? It's not about that. It's about the employer can only pay them less than what they produce. If they pay them more than what they produce, then they're losing money. They're losing value. That destroys value. That's bad for everyone in the long run.
Oh yeah,
see, it's
you just reminded me of Bernie Sanders with the free healthcare, free college, free everything.
Oh yeah, isn't that great? What a great political platform.
Right.
I'm just gonna run on the campaign promise that if you elect me, everyone's gonna be twice as handsome, twice as beautiful. You're gonna live twice as long. You can eat whatever you want, not gain a pound. I'll make a law stating that explicitly. So if that happens, it'll be illegal.
Right, because once you make something illegal, it does not happen, right?
Exactly.
We need to eliminate rape. Just make it illegal.
No, of course, yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah, these politicians, like they pander to the base desires, base instincts of the people. You know, of course, you know, everybody wants something for free. Everybody's looking for a bargain. But then, you know, you got to realize what, you know, economic reality. Like, wait a minute. Somebody had to work for that thing, right? So then am I getting it for free?
No, you can pick education off of an apple tree. You know? It's right along there.
Right. And the other funny part is, like, you know, as all these socialist countries, you know, in the Eurozone and Puerto Rico and various places are collapsing, you know, you have a socialist candidate come to power and he's like garnering all this support. Yay!
Yeah. Well, you know, I really do hope, I know I'm kind of digressing here, but I really do hope that Bernie Sanders does get elected president, because the ship is going down no matter what at this point.
Right.
So when it does, I want a very explicitly socialist at the helm. So maybe, just maybe, people will finally wake up and say, wait a minute, maybe this is not a good idea. You know, if you have Rand Paul at the helm, of course, when the ship goes down, even though it's because of everything else that's been happening the last couple hundred years,
right.
They're going to blame it on free markets and quasi-libertarians or whatever. So.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Like Adam Kokesh is running for president in 2020. There's a guy, Daryl Perry, running in 2016 also on the, like, yeah, dissolve the federal government platform. And you're right, like what happens if he does get elected, although I really don't think that he will be, but, you know, if he does, you're right, like, people will blame everything that's going to be happening under his rule. As if, and that's the other funny part, is, like, one guy on the top is blamed for every single thing that happens in a complicated, diverse economy with billions of people transacting, billions of transactions. And that guy was responsible for all of it, right? Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, it's crazy because, the reality of it is that the president himself is really responsible for very little of it because he's just a puppet.
Right,
he's just a puppet. He's just a figurehead. That's why no matter who's in there, no matter what they promise, government always gets bigger in all areas. Debt always increases. Mm. War always perpetuates. It doesn't matter who's in there. It's the guy is just a puppet. He's there to take all the blame, so you're looking at him while the puppet masters are really out of sight, out of mind, somewhere else. So, anyways,
like the Wizard of Oz, the guy behind the curtain, and then you see the big, you see the big phantasm, the big hallucination.
But, that's right.
But yeah,
thanks, yes. Obama.
Yeah, right. You didn't build that.
Yeah.
That was the I think that was Hillary. Hillary said, "What did she say? That don't let anybody tell you that businesses, what did she say, produce wealth or something like that, or make things or something, or create wealth, something like that.
don't
create jobs. That's it. Don't let everyone tell you that businesses create jobs, something like that.
Well, let's test that theory, Hillary. Let's eliminate all the businesses and see how many jobs are left.
Right. I'm just gonna make a law that we need this number of jobs by this year, and it shall be done.
Oh, jeez.
So I don't want to keep you any longer. But can you plug your website, your book once again before we sign off?
Yes, the book is called A Spontaneous Order: The Capitalist Case for a Stateless Society. You can find it on Amazon right now, and very soon I'll be launching a website for it as well called aspontaneousorder.com. You can learn more about the Blue Ridge Liberty Project on Facebook, as well as through our website at www.brlp.org, and you can find my YouTube channel at www.youtube.com/ancapchase. Very shortly here, I'll be releasing more videos which correspond with each chapter of my book, so look forward to that. And I think that just about covers it.
Awesome. So before we go, I'd like to ask this of a lot of my guests. If you were to meet somebody that maybe is considering libertarianism or voluntarism or is on the fence about it, what would you tell that person to help them understand it more or or change their views? What would you say?
If they were wanting to,
or just interested in learning and considering it on the fence, unsure, what is?
Oh. Well, I'm biased. I'd say read my book.
read my book and come back to me in a few weeks, and then we'll talk.
Yeah, there you go.
All right.
Most efficient way.
Or you can send them to your website. I mean, your YouTube channel. You got a lot of great content on there, too. So.
Yep. I hate reinventing the wheel.
yeah, that's true. Very true. All right. Awesome conversation, Christopher. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you, Danilo.
So this is so. By the way, if you want to donate to my channel to help us out, because freedom is wonderful, but it's certainly not free because it requires resources. you can donate Bitcoin or PayPal. I'll be still working on my Patreon. Got to get that set up. I'm a victim of procrastination. So yeah, that sucks. But awesome conversation, Christopher. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. So this is Peaceful Anarchism on the Voluntary Virtues Network and theseedsofliberty.com and theconsciousresistance.com. Wishing everyone have a wonderful day. Take care. Bye.